The man they call Cookie is paying us a sweet visit today, and we at Musings on Golf are eager to gobble up the stories he has to share about a wonderful life in our great game. Along with my good pal and executive producer, Jenna Self, I am Kelly Elbin, welcoming you to our final episode of October 2025, and are you ever in for a real treat? In addition to the interview, you will hear shortly with 11-time PGA Tour winner John Cook. We'll celebrate a well-earned honor for a friend of mine. We'll look more closely at the PGA Tour's decision to cancel the Century, the signature event that has long kicked off the tour year. And I'll give you some eye-popping figures, albeit at a very high altitude, for Michael Brennan, who came through with a sterling victory at the Utah Bank Championship on Sunday. Let me remind you also that the great Gary Player will be joining us on Thursday, 2 days ahead of Mr. Player turning 90 years of age. And what a conversation we're looking forward to having with the Black Knight on Thursday. Before I get to John Cook, I want to congratulate a friend of mine by the name of Matt Shagrew. I grew up playing junior golf with Matt Shagrew at Bethesda Country Club outside of Washington, D.C., and he was a terrific player back then. Matt went on and played for the University of North Carolina Chapel Hills golf team, had a solid career as an insurance executive, but he kind of got burned out and literally kind of he walked away from the game of golf for a while. And at the age of 49, Matt Shagrew had a career change. He went back to graduate school, is now a clinical psychotherapist. He works with elite athletes on the mental side of their game. He's also a licensed marriage and family therapist in both Maryland and Virginia. And the purpose that Matt Shagrew has found off the golf course has served him so well on the golf course. He's gotten back into the game in a big way. In 2014, he was the runner-up in the Senior British Amateur. 2016, he was the runner-up in the U.S. Senior Amateur. He's won the Maryland Senior Open. He's won the Virginia Senior Open. Matt Shagrew has played in more than 35 national championships around the world. And in fact, I mentioned the U.S. Senior Amateur. 9 times he's tried to qualify for match play in the U.S. Senior Amateur, and 9 times, every time, he's advanced to match play. So for Matt Shagrew to be honored last week, to be inducted into the Virginia Golf Hall of Fame, I couldn't be happier for an individual. I could not be more pleased to see someone who really had a course correction in his life and has put himself on such a great path personally and professionally. By the way, Matt joins Vinny Giles in the Virginia Golf Hall of Fame. And for the life of me, and I'll continue to advocate for this, how Vinny Giles, one of the greatest amateur golfers of all time, is not in the World Golf Hall of Fame is completely lost on me. Matt Shagrew, congratulations. Thrilled for you. And many more great rounds and many more lives that you continue to touch. John Cook, the interesting thing about John Cook, always liked John Cook. Only met him a couple of times. Always liked him as a person. Learn more about him through this interview that I conducted with John last week. His dad, Jim, really been instrumental in John's career. Jim worked and ran a number of events at Firestone Country Club, also out west, where Firestone actually sent Jim to work for them out there in Southern California. His dad was also a football coach. You're going to hear some great college football names as well. John Cook was mentored really under the great Ken Venturi. You're going to hear stories about Venturi, Tom Weisskopf's role in getting John back out east and making sure that John matriculated at The Ohio State University, where John went on to. I mean, what a stellar career. I mean, John Cook won the U.S. Amateur. He was runner-up in the U.S. Amateur the following year. He was on a national NCAA team champion for the Buckeyes. 11 times, as I mentioned, he won on the PGA Tour. 10 times he won on PGA Tour champions. He's one of only 19 players to have won at least 10 on both of those tours. John does great work for Golf Channel. Covers really good insight. He kind of seamlessly made that move from player to analyst and does a lot of work covering the PGA Tour champions as well as college golf. And finally, as I set up this interview for you, John is very candid when he talks about the 1992 season. That's when he came oh so close to capturing a major championship. He fell a shot short to Nick Faldo at Muirfield, the Open Championship. That's the one that he still thinks about for sure, and understandably so. He really should have won that championship. And then following month, he played really well, tied for second at the PGA Championship. Nick Price won at Belrive in St. Louis. But you'll really enjoy this interview with John Cook. Good man. Lots that he covers here. It's a really full life as a golfer, and you'll hear that right after this from our good friends, our corporate partners at William & Harry and Titleist. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee, more control with your irons, more spin with your wedges, and more opportunity to shoot your lowest score.
Eleven times our guest today proudly entered the winner's circle on the PGA Tour. His stellar resume also includes a U.S. amateur title, an NCAA team championship at his beloved alma mater in Columbus, Ohio, and a spot on the last U.S. Ryder Cup team to win on foreign soil. Today you can see him delivering excellent work as an analyst for Golf Channel and generally keeping an eye on the elite level of our great game. So pleased to welcome John Cook to Musings on Golf. John, you're in Arkansas. You got a lot going on with PGA Tour champions, right?
I do, Kelly. Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to finally connect with you and talk about our great game and whatever else might come. You never know what might come along here, but thanks for having me. I'm honored to be with you. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that very much, John. And before we came on, we were chatting a little bit about the fact that I'm going to have an opportunity in a couple of days to talk to Mr. Gary Player in advance of his 90th birthday. And you mentioned, John Cook, that your very first Masters, your first two rounds happened to be with none other than Gary Player. How did that come to be, John?
Yeah, it's amazing. 90 years old. That's incredible. But my being the defending U.S. amateur champion, he was the defending Masters champion. That was the pairing for the very next year in the first round. And I was fortunate enough to play with Mr. Player the first round. I played really nicely. I shot 71, one under par. And I knew Mr. Player from a few years before. His son Wayne had played some amateur golf in the United States in our great little amateur circuit, the Northeast Amateur, Porter Cup, Western Am. You know, some great events, Sonny Hanna, you know, those were great events, still are great events, still going at this point in time. So I was familiar with Mr. Player. So it was a very comfortable pairing for me, my very first Masters.
Yeah, comfortable. And I'm wondering, John, just in general, though, what was it like to step on the first tee the first time you played the Masters? What's it like, John Cook?
It was incredible. It was something that I never thought, you know, could be possible. Honestly, I was working towards, you know, being a very good, you know, good player. And so my first Masters, I was so fortunate enough to play three practice rounds with my great friend and mentor. I know we're going to get into Ken Venturi.
Yeah.
So I played three practice rounds with Kenny, Tom Weisskopf, and Ed Snead. And if you remember, Ed Snead in 1979 was the guy. He unfortunately lost in a playoff to Fuzzy.
Fuzzy, yeah.
And he had bogeyed the last three holes. And I remember playing these three practice rounds with Kenny, Tom, and Ed. And we walked off on Wednesday morning after, you know, playing some holes. And Kenny said, "Ed's ready. Ed's going to win." And sure enough, with, you know, three holes left, he was in the driver's seat. So felt bad for Ed, longtime friend. Great connection there with Ed. He did go on and win a couple of events later on in his career, but that was one that got away from Ed.
Now, no question about it. And I want to talk with you about Mr. Venturi in a minute. John, can we talk a little bit about the Ryder Cup? As I mentioned at the start, you were on the team at the Belfry in 93 that defeated the Europeans 15-13. Last time the U.S. has won overseas. Interesting. You and Chip Beck went out on that Saturday afternoon, I believe it was. You beat Colin Montgomery and Nick Faldo in four ball. John, first of all, just some general thoughts, what it was like to represent the United States at the Ryder Cup back then. And then as a follow-up, maybe some thoughts right now as to what you may see the Americans need to do to kind of right the ship, if you will.
Well, it was another one of those dream come trues. I've been so fortunate in this game, Kelly, that, you know, I did get to represent the U.S. in the Ryder Cup. I represented the U.S. in the World Amateur Team Championship. I was selected for the Walker Cup, but I unfortunately had to decline that because it conflicted with the NCAAs in 1979, which we went on to win at Ohio State, so that I fulfilled that dream as well. So I would have loved to have played the Walker Cup, but unfortunately it didn't work out. I was selected. But I so enjoyed team golf because I was a team guy. I played football and basketball in high school. I my father was a coach. He was a football coach, a high school and college football coach. So I got the team part of that. In 1993, we were a team. Tom Watson was our captain. He had spoken at length with Roy Williams, who was then the basketball coach at Kansas. And so it was a total team atmosphere there at the Belfry in 1993. What I remember most that match, Chip and I had not played a hole yet. We had not been in a match yet going into Saturday afternoon. I was wondering, am I going to play? I don't even know if I'm going to play. I don't know why. I'd had a wonderful year in 92. I had a very nice year in 93. But that was the way it was. You know, I mean, sometimes you have to have role players. Chip and I were those role players. We were sent in to take care of some business on Saturday afternoon. We kept our game sharp. We were allowed to play some holes. We went out and watched some matches. So we were in the atmosphere. We were on the practice tee on that Saturday afternoon, and Tom had come up to both of us and said, "Are you guys ready?" I said, "Ready to go. Let's go." He goes, "Well, good news is you're in, and you've got Colin Montgomery and Nick Faldo, the number one and number three players in the world." And, you know, I was still in the top 10 in the world ranking at that point in time. Chip was still a very, very good player, and we were ready to go. And the things I remember most during that match, Kelly, was Faldo made a putt on the very first hole. Well, before that, my wife, as I was walking off the putting green, gave her a kiss on the cheek, and she says, "John, you need to settle down." She knew I was like, my eyes were like so wide open. She said, "Chew this piece of gum." And I'd never chewed gum. And she said, "Gave me this piece of gum." And that settled me down. It kind of got me, oh, okay, I don't want to bite my tongue, so I got to concentrate on chewing. I need to forget about all this that's going on. I got to the first tee, and I was ready to go. Chip and I were ready to play. And I remember on number one, Faldo had made a 25-footer for birdie, and it's like, okay, what's this beatdown going to be? And I made a putt right on top of him to have him. Mm-hmm. And then we won the next hole, and we were one up. And we were one up in the match most the whole way. But the one thing I remember we got on one of those holes, maybe four or five, and I had it in there like 8 feet for birdie. Chip had, he's got like a 4 footer for par. He was going to make that. And Faldo and Montgomery, all they had kind of similar putts, but they were outside of mine. And I asked Chip to come over and, hey, what do you think about this putt? He goes, ah, you got this. You're a top 10 player in the world. You know what wow. you're doing. You're going to make this anyway. But look at those four over there. They're two of the best players in the world, and they can't figure out their putts. But you got yours. And that settled me down so much because we know Chip. He's like the most positive person on the planet. That settled me right into the match. And from then on, we just matched them hole for hole, shot for shot. You know, if they made something happen, we responded right away. And I hit a beautiful 4-iron in on the last hole, being one up as they were out of play. They were not going to barely make a par. Then I hit a nice shot in there, and Faldo hit a bunker shot and was outside of mine. He rolled his by, and he just kind of gave me mine. So it was an incredible match. It got us back in the game. It got us back into a position where we could win. But, you know, the second part of your question kind of leads off of that is right now it seems like the U.S. team doesn't play with a sense of urgency, a sense of purpose. They love what they're doing, and they're so super good at what they're doing. And it's not that they don't want to win. But if you watch the Europeans, Kelly, they play with a sense of urgency. They match shots. They pitch in. They make putts. Whatever the U.S. does, they match it. Whatever Europe does, U.S. doesn't really match it. It's interesting to me that they don't play with a sense of purpose like we did. We played with urgency. We did not want to get beat, no matter what it was going to take. So I think that the U.S., I wish they would play more golf. Not that they're not ready, not that they're not golf ready, but it seems like the Europeans, they play not only with urgency, but they play a lot of golf. They support their tour. They support the PGA Tour. U.S. players have their beautiful, great schedule, signature events that only 50 players can get in. Pretty comfortable. They don't really have to scratch and claw and play with sense of urgency like, you know, back in those days. The only way you get Ryder Cup points back in those days, Kelly, was to finish in the top 10 in a tournament. If you finished 11th, you were SOL. You didn't make a point. Right. So you had to scratch and claw your way onto these teams, and you had to play with urgency. I wish there was some system that would make them, you know, play with a little more urgency.
John, I like that word a lot, urgency. And I know that both sides now are able to have the captain select six players.
Six players. We had two.
Exactly. John, I would like to, I don't know if it's two, but I don't think it's six. And again, whoever the next captain is, as you said, give me a guy who's earned his way onto the team, right?
Totally. Completely agree, Kelly. We had two picks, and Lanny Watkins was one. He wasn't quite 50. He was in his 40s, but Raymond Hoy was 50 years old, and he had won a tournament on the PGA Tour, but he was still playing, and he was very relevant. So 10 of us earned our way on through the points for 92 and 93.
Right.
And we had two picks and two Hall of Famers. I mean, man.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't.
And two guys who would step on your throat, too.
100%. Talk about urgency.
Yeah.
You stared Raymond Floyd in the eyes on Sunday on the first tee, and you, woo, this is something different. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I think the PGA of America really, John, needs to figure out a lot of this. And maybe in some ways they do need to emulate some of what the Europeans have done successfully. I think there's a lot to it. You went to Ohio State, obviously. I know there's a tremendous amount of influence that both Jack Nicklaus and Tom Weisskopf have had in your life. But whenever I say the name Ken Venturi, I know that brings a smile to your face as it just did. Can you talk a little bit? I know you were born in Toledo, then you moved cross country. Why did you move cross country to begin with to Southern California? And then please, John, the role that Mr. Venturi played in your life and continued to play for a long, long time.
Yeah, I miss that man every day. He was a great man. Yeah, born in Toledo. My father was a graduate assistant at Ohio State. He went to Denison, played football, went to Ohio State to graduate school. He was a graduate assistant for Woody Hayes in the middle 50s. He got a head coaching job up in Toledo at Maumee High School in 56. I was born in 57, in the fall of 57. He moved on down to Mansfield and was a high school football coach at Mansfield Madison in like 60, I believe, 59, 60. My sister was born in Mansfield in 1960. He then went on back to Ohio State and was a assistant coach there for Woody, offensive line coach. Bo Schembechler was the offensive line coach at the time. Dad was, one of his assistants. And we got moved up to Akron University, where he was the assistant head coach at Akron University, the Zips. So he was the assistant head football coach with Gordon Larson. And he was the head baseball coach, and he was the mathematics teacher there at the university. So,
wow,
with two kids and, you know, a wife traveling, he caught the eye of Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, and Firestone hired him to run a couple stores, and they liked him so much that they moved us out to California, where he was going to be the head of the racing division. Out there in Southgate. Well, we could either gone to, I always get these mixed up, I think Latvia or New York or California. And my mom said, California, that's where we're going.
Right.
But in the meantime, being an employee of Firestone, we could join Firestone Country Club for $300 a year for a family membership. Mm. And that's how my sister Kathy and I got involved in golf. Down there in the little group lessons, we were kids. I mean, I was, what was I, 7 or 8 years old, and Kathy was maybe 5 or 6 years old at the time. So we started a junior program there at Firestone, but we moved out to California. I was in second grade, I believe, third grade,
yeah.
Third grade, I think, into Southern California, and, kind of took it from there.
And you moved to Mission Hills. Is that how you met Mr. Venturi?
So yeah, so we had a place there in Palos Verdes. Dad worked out in Southgate, so he'd make that trek every day, developing tires and bringing people in and testing and doing all kinds of stuff. And in the meantime, Kenny was a huge auto racing fan, big time auto racing fan, and my dad kind of kept seeing him at races, introduced, and he kind of knew him from Firestone with the World Series of Golf back in the 60s and 70s. And, so they had an acquaintance. So Dad invited Kenny up to Laguna Seca for some tire testing days. And Kenny had one of the first Cobras, the old AC Cobra. And Dad put some racing tires on Kenny's Cobra and let him run around Laguna Seca so he wouldn't chunk up his tires. So Kenny being Kenny, hey Jim, anytime, anything you ever need, you just let me know. And my dad going, if you know my dad, he says, yeah, by the way,
there you go,
a kid, 14-year-old son, that's pretty good player, he's a good player, he knows his way around the golf course and won some tournaments in Southern California. And we had just joined Mission Hills back in the day, 1970s when it opened. So this is 1971 that I got to meet Kenny. So our first meeting was, we had a house on the second tee at Mission Hills. It was a weekend place, so we'd go back and forth. Weekends we'd go down. I had a garage full of motorcycles and little go-karts and stuff, along with playing golf. So Kenny said, I'll meet you guys on the practice putting green, whatever time it was in the morning. And so I walked over there, and I've got, my shirt tails hanging out. I got a visor on backwards. My hair's down to here. It's white.
Oh.
I got OP shorts on, and, I look like a 14-year-old surf kid that played some golf. And we could hear Kenny's Cobra come through the gate, up Mission Hills Drive, slamming into the parking lot. You know, he comes waddling down there with his great little walk. It was awesome. Dressed to the nines, perfect. You know, just hair was perfect. He took one look at me, looked me up and down, and never said a word. He said, "Nice to meet you. I've got some work to do. We'll be in the office. Let's meet on the left side of the tee, practice tee, in 30 minutes. I'll be down there. And in the meantime, why don't you go around the practice area?" And it was all desert back then. There was no dye course. It was nothing. It was all sand and one big, long practice tee. And he said, "Why don't you go around, hit the golf balls back into the range so my guys can pick them up, because our members hit them all over the place." And they were out in the desert. There was balls in the desert like crazy. So I did. I walked around the range and pitched the balls back into the, and then I went over to the left side of the tee. Little did I know that Kenny was in his golf cart behind the range shed watching me do this.
Huh.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So years later. So we had our first session, and a couple years later, he said, "Hey, you remember when I asked you to go around? And you know why I did that? I wanted to see if you were going to listen to me, if you were going to pay attention to what I was going to say." And I said, right then and there, Kenny, that I had never had no question about what you were going to tell me. I was going to listen from the start. I'm a 14-year-old kid. What the hell am I going to, what do I know about this game?
Right.
So he tested me right away.
Yeah.
And then he knew that I had his trust. He had my trust. And that's how it began in 1972 is when we started working together.
John, Jim Nance has been a guest on Musing Zone Golf a couple of times. And whenever he would talk about Ken, and obviously longtime sidekick during their years in the Tower at 18, he kind of got emotional. What was it? What was it about Ken Venturi, the man and the not just the teacher, right? Not just the instructor, but the person who was so special and meant so much to, really, John, to a lot of people.
You know, if you were in his crew, and not everybody could kind of get in there. I mean, it was a pretty closed circuit, pretty closed vault. I think the amazing thing, Kelly, was he was so consistent. Things never changed. He said the same things over and over again because that's how he learned. That's what he believed.
Mm-hmm.
Our sessions together were consistent. It was never, "Hey, let's try this." It was, I had a shoebox full of scorecards with notes on those scorecards and what we worked on.
Mm.
The same three to four things every time. Every single time is grip.
What were they? What were those four? What were those things?
Grip, stance, posture, takeaway. Everything else kind of followed through after that.
Was part of that, John, for him not to make it too confusing, to stay with those basics?
That's how he learned from Byron. That's how he learned from Hogan. That's how he learned to play golf, what he figured out on his own. He was a pretty lonely kid, you know, growing up. I'm sure you know his story.
Oh, yeah.
But that the golf was the one thing that he could do by himself, and he had to learn himself. So when he, you know, hooked up with Byron, that's all they worked on was fundamentals. They played a lot of golf and remained consistent. Those really were the only things that we ever worked on, if we even worked on anything. Sometimes you'd get out of position, and he always said one thing. He said, "Great players don't get out of swing, they get out of position." So if you are aiming right, or you had, you know, played in a lot of wind, you could get real high on your right side trying to knock the ball down. And, you know, so it's just a matter of, okay, let's get back into position. And then you got back online. And that's all we worked on. And then we just go and we played golf holes. We played 36, 45 holes a day, just being, you know, learning how to play, watching him play. Where he teed the ball up on certain holes, why he teed it up on the left side 95% of the time, shaping into holes. If we ever were working on the practice tee, we never hit balls from the middle of the tee. We'd go to one side or the other, and then we would hit shots into various little pockets, shaping shots, different clubs, same distance with two or three different clubs. That's how we worked.
So a lot of course management, therefore, right, John?
Oh, that's what I learned from day one is, you know, playing golf swing on the practice tee and then taking that to the golf course and playing golf. And we didn't do a whole lot of work on the practice tee unless we really needed to, but we did a lot of work on the golf course.
So pleased to be joined by 11-time PGA Tour winner John Cook here on Musings on Golf. John, doing terrific work on Golf Channel, covering a wide variety, including some college golf and also the guys down the stretch on the PGA Tour champions here in 2025. Hey, John, ever any doubt that a guy born in Ohio who then moved to Southern California was going to end up going to the Ohio State University? Was that ever in question? And also, were Mr. Nicklaus and Mr. Weisskopf involved in some way of sort of prodding you along, John Cook?
So, you know my backstory with my dad and, yeah, you know, our love for Ohio State. We bleed scarlet and gray. So when we were in California, anytime Ohio State would come out to the Rose Bowl, of course, we were all hooked up and we'd get in the motorhome and we'd go spend all day, you know, watching the morning game, which was, well, probably the Cotton Bowl. Then we'd get into the Rose Bowl and, you know, then we'd stay in the, and then we'd watch the Orange Bowl. You know, that's how, those are the progression of whatever the games were on.
I remember it well, John. Sure.
Yeah. So when it came time to, you know, being recruited and SC, you know, being out there in California, SC, UCLA was just getting started with their golf program in the middle 70s, Arizona State, Wake Forest. I mean, I got recruited, you know, pretty heavily.
Yeah.
I knew I wasn't going to go to Wake because Gary Hallberg was going to go down there and he had the Arnold Palmer scholarship. At USC, I was just, you know, I wasn't a big SC fan because they always, you know, it was always Ohio State and SC and the Rose Bowl. So I never,
sure,
you know, we watched Ohio State beat up on OJ Simpson and the very, you know, 2 years later, you know, we got run out of the Rose Bowl. So I never really had a great affinity for USC. UCLA, I loved UCLA. And then Arizona State, I had a couple of buddies that were going to Arizona State. But when Ohio State came along, Coach Brown, he was recruiting team players. He was recruiting athletes. Everybody on that team was a really good athlete. It's something else, whether it was Mark Balin in All-State New York basketball, Rob Brewster, All-State quarterback in Michigan. He didn't play a lot of high school golf because he was, you know, at that time, fall football and fall golf. So he didn't, but he was a wonderful, wonderful junior player. Rod Spittle played hockey for the Canadian national junior team. Tom Fairgreave was a wonderful hockey player. So we had athletes on this team.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I went back and went for my visit. I met everybody and they were all athletes. So we all had a big team concept thing going. Jack wrote me a beautiful note, beautiful letter. I had not met him. My father had known Jack. And it was a wonderful, wonderful letter. About twice a month, I'd get a call from Tom. You know, we'd be at dinner and the phone would ring. My sister would answer the phone because I never answered the phone. Hey, John, Tom's on the phone. None of my friends were named Tom.
No.
I had Bill. I had Scott. I had Kirk. I had Tom. I mean, I had everybody but a Tom. And sure enough, it was Tom Weisskopf.
Ah.
And we got just chatting. And I'm going, it's Tom Weisskopf is on the phone. Jeez. And I've loved Tom Weisskopf. I love his sweaters, his Prinkle sweaters that he wore. I was thrilled. So, you know, they were a big influence. They're a big influence on me going back to school. And I just felt like if I was going to improve my game and get to another level, I needed to get out of dome golf. I needed to get out of California. And I love Southern California. Lived there for a long, long time. Arizona State, my then girlfriend, who's now my wife, she went there. And so, you know, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to go, you know, be playing golf, you know, seeing Jan, you know, a lot. It's Arizona State. It's Tempe. Who knows what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like I just needed to get away and get uncomfortable a little bit, play in some different environments.
Interesting.
our fall qualifiers were, you know, the Saturday mornings of games, and it would be 40 degrees,
yeah,
and wind blowing and leaves all over the place. And you better hone your skills if you want to play around there and play for this team. So I felt like that was going to be a natural progression.
A couple of months ago, I had Mike Small, the great golf coach at University of Illinois, on, and talked about, because Mike's been there a quarter of a century, about when he took over, John, and in a cold weather climate. And I'm one, and obviously Mike's been incredibly successful. Were there any concerns for you about, in fact, going to play in a cold weather climate at a time when, unlike today, when guys, a lot of these kids are jet setting all over and playing in warmer climates? You didn't have that luxury, I don't think, did you?
No, I won the fall qualifier as a freshman. Ralph Garassi was still there, and he was a first-team All-American. So I kind of got comfortable in that environment, and I never liked qualifying, to be quite honest. I didn't like to qualify. So I made it a point on winning qualifiers, so I didn't have to do that anymore, or not very often. So I qualified, and I think our first event was in the middle of, or first part of October. It was a cold spell. Went through there, and we played up in Ashland Country Club. The first round that I played in college, it snowed. And I shot, I don't know what, I shot 76, 75 or something. But these guys, they were ready for it. I'm going, man, I'm a California kid. I'm playing in the snow. I was a skier, but I was a decent skier, but I didn't play any golf in the snow. And I kind of started thinking, So I gave my girlfriend, Jan, my wife, a call down there at Arizona State. Do you mind, can you call George Boutel, see if he wants to give me a ring? I'm not sure I'm made out for this. She never did make the call. She said, you need to stay. And thank God, that's why we're still married, you know, some almost 50 years later.
That's great.
She was my mental mentor, I guess. So that was the only apprehension I had. After that, it was full in. I was ready to play. And, you know, I think the rest, I had a really nice freshman season.
John, with the mentoring from Mr. Venturi and the collegiate, both collegiate years under your belt, 1978, you go and win the U.S. Amateur Plainfield Country Club in New Jersey. And as you know, John, all too well, it's such a grind that week of a U.S. Amateur. The qualifying, just to get in. The matches. Oh, then you've got to play 36 holes in the final. John, what was going on so well for you that week that ended up with beating Scott Hoke in the final match and winning the first U.S. Amateur?
Yeah, great question, Kelly. Thank you. So Bobby Clampett was the number one, 77, 78. I mean, he was as good a player as there was in the world, professional, amateur, no matter what. He was the number one guy. He was winning everything. I had 2 weeks off before the USAM, and we had a place out at Muirfield that my father bought. I lived in, rented from him. I had two roommates that we were out there at Muirfield. So I was by myself. It was the end of summer. The guys weren't back yet, and I was by myself literally for 2 weeks. And all I would do, I would hit golf balls most of the day. I did see Kenny a little bit during that time, but I would go back. So he always wanted me to do things on my own. If I had a question, I could always call him. And he got me ready to practice and get ready. And so I was up there for about 10 straight days, hitting golf balls in the morning out at Muirfield, one of the great practice areas of all time. Now, this is back in the 70s. This was way before the great practice facilities. And then I would go play every afternoon by myself, walk, carry my bag, hit golf shots, play as many holes as I could get in. And I knew going to Plainfield, you know, early in that week, it's kind of how Tiger ended up preparing. He prepared a week or two before. He didn't prepare that week. So when I got to Plainfield, all I did was learn the golf course and get ready to play golf. And it worked out. I had a wonderful run. Beat some really good players early on. Beat Mike Peck in the semis. Scott beat Bobby Clampett in the semis. We both matches went extra holes. And then I played really good on that in that final round against Scott. I was Oh, I think I was like 7 or 8 up with nine holes to play, but I was like 8 or 9 under par. And it wasn't like Scott was giving me holes. I just was making a lot of birdies. So
yeah,
I knew it was ready. I knew I was ready to play, and it was no surprise to me. I felt like I was more prepared than anybody to play.
I'll be darned. I know the following year you would have loved to have followed that up at Canterbury outside of Cleveland. So you're in Ohio. Came up short against Mark O'Meara in the final match. What was it like, John, by the way, just to be the defending champion and playing in your home state? Any extra pressure? What was it like?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Now, I had the year in 79 that Bobby Clampett had the year in 78. So I won 4 or 5 big events, won some college events. Our team had won the NCAAs, won the Ohio Am, and won the Northeast Am, Sonny Hanna. You know, I was, again, ready to play. Felt like I was ready. And I think early on, I played well in the medal part. I think that was maybe the fourth qualifier. So here's my run through the match play. I played Robert Wren in the first round, PGA Tour winner. I played Wayne Player in the second round, really good player. I played my great friend, old-time friend, Lenny Clements in the third round, PGA Tour player. We went 26 holes. The afternoon, I played Gary Hallberg in the quarterfinals. I played a kid named Cecil Ingram in the semis. Don't know Cecil. Don't know what ever happened to him. Obviously a good player. And then I ran into Mark O'Meara, our old great friend again, who was having a great summer himself.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I got mentally just beat up or he played really well. I wasn't on. And the harder I tried, the worse it got. And he walked me in really early in the day. But, you know, I gave it a run. Nobody had gone back-to-back since, I think, Lawson Little in the 50s. So this is the late 70s. So it was, you know, I felt it, I think, more in the final match than any other match. That, you know, I do have a chance to win this, but
sure.
I don't have much gas in the tank, to be quite honest. And Mark played tremendous. Mark played well. He deserved it. I was really happy for him.
Hey, John, just a side note, but I think an important one. The mental side of the game, particularly when you're playing so many holes, so many rounds, it has to be, John, almost as important as the physical side of keeping your focus, your head in it, right?
Yeah, nowadays, you know, on these elite levels, it's not so much the physical. We all know what we can do physically. It is the mental grind. You have to stay in the game. And, you know, this is the middle, late 70s. There was no, you know, mental coaches. It was all, you had to grind it out. And I think, you know, Kenny was my mental coach. My dad and Kenny were my mental coaches. Dad being a, you know, old football coach, he said, you know, throw some dirt on it and get back in there. Let's go. You know, look at yourself in the mirror and see, are you doing everything you can to be better today? You know, that was your mental coach. And then Kenny was just on you on the golf course, you know, mentally staying engaged. What type of shot do you want to hit? Figure out what you want to do before you get to the ball. So when you get to the ball, all you do is react and go. We played really quickly. I learned to play really quickly, but I learned to make decisions quickly and stay in my mental game, but be in that mental game early.
I remember hearing Tiger talking to a group of kids about a 7-second rule. There's been a lot of things like that similarly. In other words, if you hit a bad shot, and we're all going to hit a bad shot, you can, whatever, for 7 seconds. Whatever, he came up with that number. Okay, it's just a random number. But then you've got the next shot to play.
Mm-hmm.
Cast that aside. It's so important, John. I mean, for goodness sakes, that was your livelihood for a long time. You almost have to be like a defensive back who gets beat on a long pass and then brush it aside, right?
What can you do? So Kenny and I had the 20-yard rule that we had 20 yards before you get to your ball, you click back in.
Mm.
You take in whatever you need. You know, professionally, I never carried a yardage book. I had a caddy do that. So 20 yards from my ball, I was clicking in to what I'm seeing, what I'm reacting to. You know, when the caddy got to the ball, gave me a number, I chose whatever, hit the shot, and then for 20 yards, I would think about what just happened, and then it was gone. So we had the 2020, 2020 rule.
Yeah, I love that. Enjoying our conversation so much with John Cook here on Musings on Health. John, California, I've been home to you for so long, and that was the home of your first PGA Tour win. And it came in really interesting scenario there at the Crosby. It was rain shortened. It ended up what being a five-way playoff, John?
Yeah. So my very first real significant win was at Pebble Beach in 75. I won the California State Amateur. Later that season, that summer, I went on won the Junior World and California State Juniors. So in 1980, I got a sponsor exemption from Nathaniel Crosby, and I played very nicely in 1980, and good enough that got me, if I wasn't exempt the next year, it got me back in to play. So I finished whatever it was in 80. So I was in knowing I was going to go to Pebble Beach. And you're right, we didn't get started until Saturday. So we had a rain out Thursday and Friday. So we're playing three courses. And so I started at Cypress Point on Friday. Saturday, I played Pebble Beach. My amateur partner was James Garner, the great actor, who I played with for about eight years after that. We had a blast. And then so Monday, we were at Spyglass. So you have all these guys finishing on all these courses, and they didn't have the great scoring systems that they do now. You know, there was a scoreboard here, a scoreboard there, and it was manual. Guys, you know, people were up there, volunteers, putting numbers. You had no idea what was going on.
Right.
And so I'm playing the front side at Spyglass. Hardest golf course it's really difficult. You can imagine in 1981. And I'm finishing on the ninth hole. And I make about a three-footer for par on the number nine to shoot, I think maybe 71, which was a good score around there. And, you know, so you saw a name. You saw Brad Bryant was at nine under par playing somewhere. There's a couple eight unders and seven unders. Tom Watson was like seven under par somewhere. Bobby Clampett was playing the front side at Cypress Point, which is very scoreable. Nine holes, and he was like it's eight under par. And then so I'm just kind of sitting around. I go back to Pebble Beach because when you got done, they said, okay, go back to Pebble Beach in case there's a playoff. You know, we're going to play the first hole at Pebble Beach. And I'm like, two shots behind already. Well, Brad Bryant didn't finish very well, he finished at six under. We heard that Bobby Clampett had to two putt from 5 feet on the ninth hole at Cypress Point, but he didn't know it. And he ended up three putting to get into, to go from eight to seven. I mean, this is fate. This is the way golf works. You know, who knows what would have happened if he two putts and he wins his first, he could have won 25 tournaments. Who knows?
Sure.
And so all this is all getting juggled around and okay. If you're on seven under par, go to the first tee at Pebble Beach. So five of us show up. And it was myself, Bobby Clampett, Ben Crenshaw, Hale Irwin, and Barney Thompson was the fifth. And Barney was in the first group off at Pebble Beach that morning and finished at seven under par. And when he finished, 10 under par was leading the tournament. And he's going to maybe have his first top 10 ever in his career. So where was he? Cap room.
Yes, of course. Right?
Cap room for 2 hours. And Barney, God love the guy. He's 6'5" from West Virginia, just an absolute athletic specimen. And he shows up on the first tee at Pebble, and he's got his kind of visors on sideways, and you could see he had a couple of beers. And you know, I talk about his son, Johnny Thompson's one of the great Callaway reps. And every time I see Johnny, we get into this funny story.
Yeah.
And sure enough, we get to the first tee and the four of us hit. And Barney is the last to hit. He pops up a three wood, doesn't go 150 yards off the tee. And he pull hooks some iron up into the houses up on the left. And he didn't even walk up. He just said, guys, tied for second is good enough for me. To the cap room. So long story short, I end up beating Hale Irwin on the third extra hole. I'd hit a shot in there really close. He had hit it over the green. Anyway, we three of us birdied the first hole, and Hale and I ended up birdying the second hole. He hit it over the green, kind of flubbed his pitch shot, and then hit his fourth shot just inside my ball. And so now I'm over this 3-footer at Pebble Beach on the third hole.
Yeah.
And it's like this table. It's just, you just know, all I try to do is just kind of lag it up there really high on that high edge. Right. And what's it do? It catches that right edge and spins off and goes like this far by.
Ah.
You know, it's Pebble Beach in the afternoon. It can get a little dicey, and Hale looks at me, and now I'm frightened over this putt right here.
Sure.
And he goes, he told me later on, he didn't mean anything by it. He just felt like I should finish. Like, yeah, you don't want to mark that.
Yeah.
Right. John, I suggest you finish. And to his credit, he knew I was, and he told me later on that I only did that because I knew what this meant, and I didn't want to win that way. You played and you hit the best shots. Just go and tap that in. Just knock it in. And I did. It looked calm, but it wasn't calm. It was a nervy little 18-incher to win my first event on the PGA Tour at Pebble Beach.
Great story. Yeah, I remember Trevino talking about when he won the PGA Championship at Tanglewood in 74, and he was battling Jack down the stretch, and he hit his putt up on 18. He had a one-shot lead, hit his putt up to a few feet, and he said to Jack, he said, I got to finish this off. I'm gagging. I can't, right? I got
to. Totally.
I got to get out of here.
Completely. My wife is on the side of the green. She's walking with Mary Crosby, and she's pregnant with our first child, and right off the side of the green, it's cold. It's getting late in the day. It's almost dark.
Yeah.
And I was very, very nervous over that little 18-incher, and I just went ahead and finished it.
Hey, John, from my time working at PGA Magazine, I can still picture you hitting just some beautiful shots at Belle Reve in August of 92 when you finished. I think you tied with Gene Sowers and somebody else 3 shots back of Nick Price. It was his week to win the PGA Championship at Belle Reve. He just was the best of the group. But you had just come off what really, John, should have been your major championship earlier, just a month earlier. What happened at the end of the Open Championship there in 92?
Yeah, it was interesting. At Muirfield in 92. Yeah, it was an incredible week. Obviously, I had played Muirfield in 1980, our rookie season. I was still exempt for that Open through my U.S. amateur win 2 years prior.
Hmm.
So Jan and I went over as pretty much newlyweds over to Scotland and played Muirfield. I missed the 54-hole cut there, but I loved the golf course, and I did not have really a chance to go back and play the Open Championship. I wanted to, but just didn't really have that opportunity until 92, and went back and knew why I fell in love with the golf course. I was very comfortable on it. So how that ended, it's so surreal sometimes, because it was such a battle day. The wind was blowing. The wind was blowing hard, 25, 30 miles an hour, like it can over there in Scotland.
Sure.
I hit a ball out of bounds on the 9th hole. I had eagled the 5th hole, the par 5. I made a birdie in there somewhere else, and then I hit a ball out of bounds on number 9 and made a 7. I'm not playing with Faldo in the final round. I'm playing with Ernie Els. Ernie Els had no status on any tour at that time. He was 20 years old, and we were playing together in the second group there at the Oak. Steve Pate was playing with Faldo, and I made a couple birdies. I birdied the 11th hole. I birdied 15, and I birdied 16, and so I had like a 2-shot lead, but you didn't really know because poor C. Page playing with Nick, and they were way behind us, like 2 holes behind us. And so you couldn't really get a sense of what was going on, but I knew all I wanted to do was just finish strong.
Yeah.
And 17 was downwind. I hit a driver and a 5-iron right in the middle of the green on the par 5, and I lipped out my eagle putt, and it went by one of those places. I marked it, waited for Ernie to putt out. I, you know, remarked my ball, got up over, went through my whole routine, you know, hit the putt, reached over to pick it out of the hole, and it missed. It hit the lip, and it went by like that. And so I tapped that in, barely.
Yeah.
Caught the edge of the hole, went in. And I had my best friend in life was caddying for me. He wasn't my normal caddy. We went overseas a lot together. Kirk Kuzmanic, he was a high school buddy of mine and great, great friend, still is to this day.
Yeah.
And we're walking over to 18T, and he wasn't really much of a golfer. He wasn't a professional caddy, but he said something to me. He says, "Still got this. Yeah, you're good. Hit your good tee shot." And man, I striped one off 18. The wind was in. It was in and out of the right, blowing about 25, 30 miles an hour. And I just piped a tee shot at 18. And like all week, if I was in between clubs, and you could run up every shot. I was in between a 3 and a 4 iron. And I remember going, "Well, it's probably a 4 iron. Just keep it on the ground. Let it run all the way up there. Get it on the green." I said, "No, I'm going to end this right here." And I took out a 3 iron and I was going to hit this like high hold shot right against the wind. I felt like I could do anything I wanted with a golf ball. And I got ahead of it and blocked it to the right and missed the bunker to the right and hit a nice pitch shot up there about 6 feet and missed it. In the meantime, it turns out Faldo made like a 20-footer for par at 16 and then did birdie 17. And now we were tied. And then he parred 18, hit a brilliant 3 iron shot, like Hall of Famers would, just almost went in the hole, end up making a par to beat me by a shot. So, that was one where, you know, that's the one I still remember. The PGA, Pricey and I played in the last round together, I think in the second group, but he was playing so good. I was kind of having a chance down the stretch, and then he made a long putt, I think on the par three, maybe 15, to take a 2-shot lead, and then he birdied 17. But he played masterfully. He was as good a player as there was. I mean, it was not a surprise.
Yeah, no question about it. John, I think I read that you're one of 19 players to have double digit victories on the regular tour and on PGA Tour champions.
I found that out myself. I didn't know
that. Yeah. Yeah, I would think that's a nice little marker to have, because you had a nice career. It wasn't the longest career on the Champions Tour, but a nice career. To win 10 times, had to be very proud of that, right?
Yeah, I am. I am, Kelly. It was a nice run. I knew there was a window. You know, there's a window out there. I passed that by a couple of years. I told my wife that when I turned 50, until I'm 55 years old, I'm going to play every event I can possibly play. Hey, this is what we did. This is where we were competitive. Our names are on our bags for reasons. I felt like I was still healthy enough. I was playing good enough. I was winning tournaments. So we're just going to let this ride out. And then, you know, a couple years later, I think right around 57 or 58, I started to wind down a little bit. Television became an opportunity.
Yeah.
And you can't do both. And I found quickly that you can't do both. And so I made that decision that I need to project to the future on what am I going to be doing at, you know, 60, 62, 65 years old.
Sure.
And this was a good opportunity. And I took that opportunity to concentrate more on television.
Did that come naturally to you, the TV side, John? Were you comfortable in front of the camera? Did somebody help? Was there a Ken Venturi who kind of mentored you, who helped you?
I talked a lot to Kenny about that. And to be quite honest, I was a very shy person for a long, long time. My wife still to this day cannot believe that I do this for a living. I didn't say 50 words a year, basically. I was just not a conversationalist. I was a math major, finance major in school. I had no command of the English language at all. I was not very good, I didn't think. But I worked with some of the best people. Early on, when I dabbled in it in the early 2000s, I worked with Fran Charles, and I learned a lot from the great Fran Charles. And then I just watched, Kenny, explain golf on how he did things. And he just talked golf. He just talked like you and I are just talking golf. He wasn't perfect. And so I learned, more and more as I went along. I worked, I got to work with the great Bob Papa, and I learned so much from Bob on, phrasing and, how to, cut your thoughts into, sentences and, little sound bites and, working with Lanny,
absolutely.
Working with, the great producers that I work with, Brant Packer, working now a lot with Rob Sharp, and just learning more and more things on, how not to be the interviewee, but be the interviewer. I was very uncomfortable doing that early on and learned, learned about that. So I have learned, I've learned a lot. I think I've gotten better. I just like you and I chatting. That's how I want the, I want this to sound is, I can tell you how to win tournaments. I won plenty. I can also tell you why I lost a lot. And one thing that Lanny always said was, don't be the second guesser, be the first guesser. Tell them what's going to happen, what should happen, and what could happen. Don't be the guy that says he should have done this or could have done this.
Yes.
Be the guy that says he should do this and why, he could do this and why. But don't be the guy that sits there on Monday morning and says, well, he should have done that. Well, shoot, anybody could do that.
I love that advice. John, always close Musings on Golf interviews with a question about a dream foursome. And over the many shows we've done, it's fascinating. Sometimes it's, I play with Tiger. I play with it. Sometimes it's family oriented. So I'll ask you, John Cook, if you could play with three individuals and sort of a dream round of golf, whether they're still with us or they're deceased, who would those three be and where would you play?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I've been so fortunate in this game, Kelly, to, go through and have, Jim Garner is one of my partners. I got to know Eddie Van Halen, like we were little brothers there for a number of years and we played some golf together. But to answer your question, it would have to be my son, Jason, my father, Jim, and Ken Venturi at Cypress Point.
Wow.
Yeah. My favorite place in the world. Favorite.
Why is that, John? What is it, by the way, what is it about Cypress Point that is so magical and mystical for so many, and the favorite, as you said, for so many good players?
Yeah, I just get up on that first, and it's not the hardest golf course in the world. It's only 6,600 yards. The first time I ever played it was in the state amateur in 1975. And it just hit me standing on that first tee, the tee shot over 17-mile drive, and just looking out and just walking through the ebbs and flows of the golf course. You go into the trees, you go out into the dunes, you go back into the trees, you go out into the dunes, and then you walk across 17-mile drive from the 14th green and you go to the 15th tee and you just go, oh my God, this is the greatest short par three on the planet. It is. It just is. And then you go to 16. You go, oh my God, this is the hardest par three. This is the hardest hole in the world. And it's a 6 handicap hole in the golf course. So it's like, oh my God. I think it's just, I just get up on that tee, first tee, and I get off that 18th green. I go, that was a great walk. Just a great walk. There's better golf courses probably, but for me, that's my resting place.
Now, this has been a great interview. John Cook, you've had a great golf life. I mean, from your dad, from those years, right up to today, still being involved. It's pretty cool, isn't it, to still have a part in the game at this point of your life, right?
Absolutely. I've been so fortunate, so blessed. I've had a great partner in life. You get me all emotional.
I understand. John, it's always one of the things that strikes me, and we'll kind of wrap it up with this. As I mentioned, my dad was the president of the PGA of America, 50 years at Burning Tree outside of D.C. To me, golf's always been about family. It's always been about family and friends, John.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's what makes our game really great.
I've had some great support. Like I said, my wife for almost 50 years now. Great family, great friends.
Yeah.
Burning Tree, by the way. I love playing there with Kenny. Oh, my God.
We played I love
five times with the Kenny, the V-man. But yeah, I'm so fortunate. Thank you, Kelly. It's I've been blessed.
We've been blessed to have you. John Cook, thanks so much. We'll see you down the road, and all the very best.
Appreciate it. Anytime.
William and Harry has entered a bold new era, led by their new Lionhead logo, a symbol of strength, leadership, and fearless ambition. Step onto the course with purpose. Outplay the field and dominate your opponent while wearing handcrafted shoes that blend performance, luxury, and unmistakable style. William & Harry offers custom designs featuring your club, company, or organization's logo so you stand out with every step. Visit williamandharry.com and use code 15OFFMOG for 15% off. William & Harry, walk with the lion. Well, we thank John Cook very much for the extended time that he gave us, the wonderful insights he provided us. Wish him all the best going forward at Golf Channel. And John is just a class act all around. A couple of things to discuss. The first being, what a great story with Michael Brennan, 23 years old. Michael Brennan won three times earlier this year on what's called the PGA Tour Americas, which is really kind of a pathway that got him into the Korn Ferry Tour, which is kind of the AAA for golf. And he said, you know what? I have no intention on playing the Korn Ferry Tour. His agent got him a sponsor's exemption into the Bank of Utah Championship last week, and he went out and won it. Not only did he win it, but how about this for some statistics? Michael Brennan at age 23 averaged 351 yards off the tee. He only missed six fairways over the course of the four rounds, hitting 89% of the fairways off the tee. This is not necessarily surprising. He played at Wake Forest. He won eight individual titles for the Demon Deacons. Big time potential here. Really big time potential. And we say that a lot. I understand that. But this is a guy who puts the ball in play straight. When you're hitting the ball that far, which is even farther apparently than the norm out there, he's going to be in position to hit a lot of close iron shots. If he makes his putts, et cetera, et cetera, this is a name to watch. This is a guy who's got future Ryder Cups written all over him. This is a guy who's got major championship potential written all over him. Yes, it's only one event, but his age, his confidence, and the length off the tee and the straightness of his driving, boy, oh boy, a lot for Michael Brennan. That's good. Now, the last thing I want to touch on is the Sentry. The Sentry has been for many years in Kapalua, Hawaii, the kickoff event for the PGA Tour. It's been canceled this year, which is a massive situation. I mean, think of the PGA Tour. The PGA Tour has existed for years and years and years to give playing opportunities to its members. And now this event has been canceled. There certainly have been drought conditions out there. There are logistical challenges that the PGA Tour set. But I felt like you all needed to learn more about this than just a drought or logistics. And I reached out to our friend Adam Shupak, senior writer for Golf Week, who covers the tour intensely. Great writer, great reporter. Said, Adam, can you give me some insight? And this is what he wrote back. This is a much more complicated issue than being termed a water drought. I think we're a long way from getting to the bottom of it, but I think the more telling aspect at this point is that the PGA Tour let the Sentry not happen. In the Brian Rolapp era, Brian is the new guy at the top of the food chain for the PGA Tour. He wrote, in the Brian Rolapp era, a tournament that will lose the tour money will not be played. And Brian, not too long ago, used the word scarcity. It was one of his words for the PGA Tour, which a lot of people have meant that they're going to be fewer tournaments. And I also asked Adam what this meant for the Sony Open, which is the second event out there. And this is a signature event. The Sentry is a signature event. All the top players are supposed to play in it. Now, if you're going to travel that far to Hawaii, you're probably going to then play in the Sony Open the following week. And he wrote, I agree, this is clearly bad for Sony Open. The top players who do typically play both Hawaii events are unlikely to go. And he made a good point. He said, but you could fall behind the eight ball pretty quickly these days, and it's hard to get starts early. So I think a lot of players without security of a multi-year exemption from winning will still go if they like the course. He ended it by saying something that I think is probably the most prescient point of all of this. He said, Sony's deal is up after this year. I think they are the longest running title sponsor now, and the whole Hawaii swing could be in jeopardy. Then he wrote, although Century is signed through 2035, as the tour's future competitive committee evaluates the schedule moving forward. Adam, thank you very much for that really insightful information there. This is something to really closely watch. Again, the PGA Tour, as we've known for years and years, is going to look very, very different. It's a for-profit product in many ways now, and fewer events are possible. And if that means that you no longer see the Hawaii swing, I wouldn't be surprised at all. So a lot to it. Again, John Cook, thank you so much. Looking forward to talking to Gary Player on Thursday for ahead of his 90th birthday. Matt Chagrew, congratulations. Virginia Golf Hall of Fame. Young Mr. Brennan, way to go in Utah. So happy to wrap up another Musings on Golf. Janice Self in Houston, Kelly Elbin in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Happy trick or treats. Give the good stuff. Give the Hershey bars. Give the Kit Kats. Give the Snickers. Have fun with the kids. Signing off, Musings on Golf.